APCGB.
What does the B stand for?
C Gamer Podcast. Bobcat.
PC Gamer Bobcat.
Hello and welcome to the PC Gamer Podcast. This week we're going to talk a little bit about Left 4 Dead 2 DLC Crash Course that we've been digging into. We're going to talk about the new Dawn of War 2 standalone expansion pack, Chaos Rising, that we revealed in our December issue. We'll talk a little bit about State of Steam as a Service and Mass Effect 2's new character. It's Thursday, October 1st. Happy new month, everybody. This is episode number 194, and I'm happy to introduce our new intern, my new intern. I think I've claimed him for my own. Eric Belsauce, everyone. Welcome to the podcast, Eric.
Glad to be here. It's my first day of work, and I'm already getting started.
Fantastic.
What do they have you doing in there, Eric?
Well, I cleaned up my desk a lot, and I'm really just waiting for IT to put me on the network so I can actually get some real work done.
Yeah, I guess Josh left a huge mess over there, didn't he?
It's what I do best. I did leave him a book that he's also reading, so that's fair.
Well, that's certainly productive for a magazine, Josh.
It's a book about games. It's okay.
All right, so let's run down the rest of our cast real quick. As you heard, we do have Dan Stapleton here, remotely from home.
Yeah, I'm working from home today. One of the perks of this job is occasionally being able to work remotely, not to brave public transportation.
Are you in your pajamas, Dan?
No, I've dressed up for this one.
Ooh. Well, we're thankful. And Josh Augustine, of course. You may have heard him moments ago.
You may have. I've moved from books to beer steins. I'm sporting my World of Warcraft beer stein filled with water for the podcast. Staying sober for you guys.
Are you sure it isn't like vodka? I might have to check.
Nope, stay over there.
It does sound like a wasted opportunity.
It does.
Well,
and as always, Andy Bauman, podcast producer extraordinaire. Andy?
No, I thought you were going to add something else. So I was like, oh. Considering doing today's podcast in the A-track format, because everybody was giving me some suggestions on what formats we should be doing this in. I have my own Sony proprietary A-TARC. People with mini disc players will be able to listen, and that's about it.
I remember those.
Yeah,
oh, my goodness. All right, gentlemen, let's jump right into it. I think it was like Monday or Tuesday, or over the weekend maybe, BioWare put out a new trailer revealing a new character for Mass Effect 2, a new party character called Subject Zero, and it got a good amount of buzz over the weekend. Some amount of backlash, I sort of hesitate to call it that, but some negative response from some members of the community that this character is too contemporary. It was sort of like this bald female former gang member, and she's very brash. Like she swears at one point in the trailer, and it's bleeped over and
scandalous.
I know, right? And then she makes a reference to sex and seemingly like moves in on your character at the end of the trailer.
You mean this?
Sex? Maybe you should just say so.
Oh, yes.
Andy, I knew I could count on you. That's lovely.
I mean, first of all, there's always going to be some complaint about any character. I mean, and that's what internet forums are for people to bitch and moan about everything, you know. Although, I mean, my personal take on this character is it might be a little bit too, like, extreme, you know, a little bit too,
I'm right there with you, dude. Yeah.
Right. It's a little bit over the top.
It's really cliche. I mean, the overdone tough girl, you know, I mean, it's just,
There were a couple of neat things about her. I mean, I don't hate the character based on that trailer. But yeah, it looks like they could stand to tone it down a little bit.
I'm really curious if, I don't know, we've talked about Dragon Age and its marketing on this podcast in weeks past. I'd be curious if it's the same group of people that produced this trailer. I mean, you got the power chords in the background, you have these brash statements and you know, is that what we think of in the tradition of BioWare games? I mean, obviously they're seeking to draw the attention of people that maybe wouldn't otherwise pick up Mass Effect or take a look at Mass Effect, and that's fine. But you know,
they should have two trailers. They should have one trailer for the people that love Mass Effect, and then one trailer for the people who don't really know it very well.
Yeah, there's sort of like an age gate and a coolness gate.
Are you in or not? Because, you know? I mean, this trailer, to put it lightly, like, it kind of takes away everything that was warm and fuzzy feeling about Mass Effect.
I wouldn't say Mass Effect had a lot of warm and fuzzy going on.
Well, as far as like what it made, like how it made me feel, like I loved that game so much. So it's like, you know, it sort of took away those feelings. I was like, wait a minute, is this what that game was? I don't remember it being this way.
Well, Mass Effect is, you know, a space opera kind of dramatic kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this makes it seem like a MTV skateboarder kind of thing.
Exactly.
You know, extreme sports kind of, you know, energy drink kind of game. Whereas, you know, that's not really the tone of Mass Effect. But I mean, you look at, they did the same thing with Dragon Age, and Dragon Age is not at all that kind of game. It's just trying to, I mean, I guess they figured they've already got the audience of Mass Effect. They've already got, you know, the BioWare fans. You know, those guys are essentially a given. They're just trying to get the attention of people that don't, you know, that aren't like sci-fi fans, or in the case of Dragon Age, aren't fantasy fans. But they, you know, they might be like extreme sports, or not extreme sports in particular, but fans of that tone.
Fans of bald
extreme
women.
Extreme women fans.
Extreme women.
I don't think this is indicative of the tone of the game at all. It reminds me almost of like the Team Fortress 2, you know, Meet the Class videos, where each of the videos is toned specifically for that character. And so I think, you know, it makes sense, you know, if they're going to have a character like that, this is the perfect trailer to show that. But I don't think anyone should be worried that, oh no, the game is going to be this way or have this strong of a tone.
I was just worried. I was having a conversation with one of our freelancers over Twitter that this character, kind of what you were saying, Dan, is just seemed to be way too contemporary. I mean, just using language that, you know, seemingly people in our world would use, and not, you know, not what I think of in terms of the future and sci-fi and epic sci-fi and atmospheric sci-fi that I liked about the first Mass Effect. And he responded back, well, the whole game's really contemporary, and, you know, there's campy elements to Mass Effect. I'm like, really? Did I miss those?
I mean, it's been a while since I played it, so I don't remember specifically. But yeah, I mean, it's not so far removed from you know, contemporary culture that they're just making up words right and left, you know, and just peppering like words that don't make any sense into normal conversation, except when they're referring to specific, like, you know, like the engines of the ship or something like that, or the telekinetic powers. They weren't going overboard with the techno babble. But I will say that this character does strike me a bit like Poochie.
Oh, from The Simpsons?
Yeah.
Yes.
So, Evan, I was curious to see your reaction, because I know your one kind of complaint about BioWare games is it's very either good or evil. There's no kind of gray area. And this character does seem very gray. You know, it's hard-hitting, it's brash, it's unconventional. But, you know, she can be fighting for good or evil. Like, does that appeal to you at all, that she's not, you know, strictly evil, or she's not strictly good, somewhere in between?
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly like to have her in my party and like see what kind of role she play, and like see what kind of catchphrases she throws and things like that. And I think in that sense, I'm glad you brought that up.
I think it goes like this.
If this is just about sex, maybe you should just say so.
I think that's what she says
during combat.
Yeah,
it's absolutely. But I'm glad you brought that up, Josh, because I think with what we understand about the plot of Mass Effect 2, I hope I'm not giving anything away, Shepard is sort of on the run a little bit. He's forming this sort of ragtag group of the most dangerous people in the universe, which, you know, again, does fit in that gray area of being a mercenary and whatnot. So she fits into that, and that's fine. So,
yeah, I would actually say, you know, in addressing your earlier statement about BioWare games being too black or white, good or evil, and Mass Effect was a big exception to that, because, I mean, one of my criticisms of it was that you couldn't really be evil. You could be a jerk, but you couldn't be evil. And one of the big problems I had with it was, you know, towards the end when you're facing off against the main enemy, and, you know, he's going all super evil, and he's like, join me. And your character automatically says, no, I'm not going to join you. You don't, like, especially for a BioWare game, I was shocked that I didn't get the chance to say, okay, I'll join him and then go kill all the good guys. I mean, like that's exactly like what you had the chance to do in the KOTOR games. And that you know, was very jarring for me, actually.
Interesting. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. I actually didn't, I was trying to remember if you had that choice explicitly at the end, because I definitely chose to be good, or remember choosing to be good. But I'm glad you brought up KOTOR as well, Dan. You directed me to a news story on MaximumPC.com that there's a mod out there that's making some adjustments to the ending of KOTOR 2, which some people felt kind of, you know, cut things off too quickly. It wasn't really... I remember that being one of the main criticisms of the game and the reviews when they were out there.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty blatantly obvious that the ending that was in the final game was not what the ending was intended to be. I mean, it just very abruptly cuts off. And that has in large part been attributed to the fact that when Obsidian was making it, LucasArts suddenly moved the release date up about 4 months. So they had much less time to finish that than they thought they were going to have. There were a lot of plot threads that were just left dangling. There were references to things throughout the game that just never showed up. And it was a very hastily done ending that annoyed a lot of people, including myself. And like, other than that, it was a great game other than that, but it kind of fell flat at the end. So and also, like, you know, what made it particularly obvious to modders when something had messed up the ending was when they went in and looked at all of the all the files, they found, you know, pieces of the you know, ending that was supposed to be that just were cut out and were not used by the game in any way. So there was this mod project, and I actually think there were a couple of versions of the mod project, a couple of different teams working on it, that that was aiming to restore the original ending, the original intended ending. And this one finally came out. It took them years and years to actually get around to it. And you know, that's kind of the thing about mods is, you know, they're all kind of, people are working on this because they have to, because they want to, not because they have to, not because they're being paid. Nobody's livelihood depends on this mod coming out. So you're kind of lucky if a mod ever actually is completed. This one, which, let's see, it's the Maximum PC story links to a Eurogamer story, which links to something else, I'm sure. But so there was one like really ambitious version of this mod that was being produced by one team called Gizka, or Gizka, team-gizka.org, that I guess still isn't available. But there's another one called Deadly Stream. Go to deadlystream.com. And you can find there like a beta version of their mod they put out that actually has the full ending, or at least most of the full ending, restored. And I'm actually really looking forward to playing this, because they're just a bunch of, like I said, a bunch of plot threads that were left hanging, that, you know, we just don't know what was supposed to happen with those characters. So I'm definitely going to give this a shot. I was actually planning on replaying KOTOR 1 because it's out on Steam now, but I have not gotten around to that either.
That seems really interesting, but I haven't played the game in so long. I wouldn't know who any of these characters are, so I don't think the ending would really help me at this point.
Well, I mean, it's not like you just start up and then play the ending. You replay the game and the ending is there.
In the case of Obsidian, if Alpha Protocol is delayed, I mean, that could have very well been the decision of Obsidian, because they've had a couple games canceled, haven't they? I mean, the Aliens RPG is the most recent one.
And it's never a decision of one party or the other, and it's usually a mutual decision to delay a game. It's the developer saying, hey, you know, we could really use more time to get this right, and the publisher saying, okay, we think that would work. You know, we think it's worth it to put in the extra time, and we're likely to see a return on that investment.
Right, I agree. I would just say that if it were delayed, I would not expect it to be because of the other games we've seen delayed this year. I don't think it would fall into that same pattern of, oh, we're not going to sell as much in Christmas time.
You don't think AP? Can we call it AP?
Sure.
Sure.
You don't think AP would get lost in the shuffle, as it said?
It could very well, and that is another possible reason for delays, which is publishers want to, you know, put it in the best possible release window for that, you know, to make the most money off the initial sales. And the developers are almost never sad about that because then they get more time to polish it. So, yeah.
It's got really cool box art.
I'm looking forward to it.
Good.
So, I mean, that's one of those things where and especially with a tracker like Obsidian's, where they do tend to have some buggy releases, where a delay, you know, okay, I want to play the game, but I would not throw a fit if it's delayed because I want them to polish it more.
Sure.
So I'm going to play KOTOR 2 now again.
I want to. I don't know if I'll have the time. Yeah. It is a time-consuming game.
I'd probably replay Mass Effect before I did KOTOR.
I might have to replay the KOTOR games just to get ready for the Old Republic.
How about this, Dan? If you play one, I'll play the other one. Then we can kind of tell each other what happened to remind ourselves.
I remember pretty well. I think I replayed KOTOR 1 a couple of years ago.
Book reports? Live book reports? But game reports.
It sounds like a terrible idea to tell each other about a 50-hour gameplay experience.
Play by play.
Yeah, that sounds awful.
All right. So earlier this week, Valve finally gave us an excuse to crack Left 4 Dead back open with the addition of Crash Course, the long-awaited DLC pack, two maps long. Who's played it? First of all, Dan and I have.
I have.
Cool.
Yeah.
Great. What'd you think, Eric?
Well, actually, I didn't realize it was only two courses long when I downloaded it. And so me and a group of strangers, because none of my friends were online, we played through it and we were having fun. And it's good. It ends too quickly, in my opinion. Like, I enjoyed that they, like, continue the storyline, you know, like after the helicopter crash and stuff. It's got good action. It's got good climax moments. What do they call those?
Crescendo.
Yeah. Crescendo, yeah. It just feels, after having played, you know, so many like hour or hour and 15 minute campaigns in the normal Left 4 Dead, it just feels short, I guess. But it's a good like palate wetener for Left 4 Dead 2, because that's only like a month away. So,
yeah, it's definitely a snack. I think you hit that on the nose, and I think it's a good snack. Dan and I played it twice in 2 days.
I don't really have an issue with it being short. I mean, there are plenty of longer experiences out there already. I mean, there are the four other campaigns, and just because this one isn't the same length as those, and that seems like an odd complaint to me. Especially since it's not trying to give the exact same experience as the rest of them.
I guess it wasn't so much a complaint as just what I initially. I've only played it through once, and that's kind of like just my initial impressions. It's a great. It's really fun. I mean, I enjoyed the experience.
So, Evan, you've played the most Left 4 Dead out of anyone here, I'd say.
Well,
Ryan, what is your professional opinion of the design of the Crash Course levels?
So it's absolutely, and I can really definitively say it's a bridge between Left 4 Dead 2 level design, which I've played through three of the five campaigns all the way through of Left 4 Dead 2, and Left 4 Dead 1. I mean, they basically repurposed a lot of the urban textures and you know the car models and things like that from No Mercy, from the second chapter of Left 4 Dead 1 as well. But there's like some, just the openness of a lot of the areas is very distinct from the original Left 4 Dead, in that you sort of enter a space and there'll be lots more side rooms, lots more avenues, at least two more routes to get to your objective. And still, I was saying while we were playing, Dan, if you ever get lost, just look for that one, you know, enormously bright light in the environment, because that's what tells you where you need to go, and that's ever present in every section of Left 4 Dead's maps. But I think, frankly, it's one of the better sections in terms of design. In terms of there's a few vertical elements in there where you're dropping down onto a bridge. I mean, it's minor, but like there's so little of that in Left 4 Dead 1, and there's so much of that in Left 4 Dead 2 from what I've played, that it's nice to see sort of those elements coming together and seeing Valve put its expertise to work in the DLC.
What impact do you think having the wide open spaces has on the gameplay compared to the relatively tight corridors that dominate most of the Left 4 Dead 1 maps?
So, I mean, of course you're going to get a little bit more lost, and I think that's a positive thing in the sense that, I mean, at least maybe I'm saying this because I've played the first game's maps so much and I know them by heart, but you're going to explore a little, people are going to get lost. There's more opportunities in versus mode for smokers to pull people down corridors. But just a better feeling of not just being in a bigger world that you don't feel like you're being led by the nose to where you need to go as much. I mean, I sort of, especially in versus mode, all those corridors and No Mercy and Death Toll, I don't know, they kind of wear on you. Even most of the outdoor environments, with a few exceptions, are pretty narrow.
It's a slightly different flavor from all the rest of the campaigns, at least. I mean, it just with all the openness, and it makes fighting tanks a different experience because you're not quite as limited. You're able to, you know, kind of circle strafe them a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
And easier. It's actually a little bit harder to nail them with a Molotov now, right? In that kind of setting.
I think so, yeah, because you don't have the explicit bottleneck where you know they're obviously going to come through. They have to reach you through. We had a funny moment. I'm remembering now. We were playing last night with Will and Norm from MaxPC. It was Norm and Andy, actually. And right at the end of the finale, I don't want to give everything away, but I got crushed by a car that's the rescue vehicle.
Oh, right.
It was being lowered. I wasn't crawling under it. I was just kind of running past it to save somebody that was incapacitated. And somehow, like, the geometry collided with me, and I just died instantly.
Well, you were almost dead already, and you ran underneath the lowering car, and it squished you.
Well. So. Pardon me. But I think, just to call out a couple more elements, the crescendo event with the turret mounted on the back of the truck bed, I think, that's definitely, I mean, just that model, that's something I remember seeing in Left 4 Dead 2 on the bridge. And in addition, right after that moment, you're sort of crossing a bridge that's filled with cars. There's a lot of moments like that in Left 4 Dead 2 where you're running, Valve does call it a gauntlet, actually. You're running through this gauntlet of cars, and you have to get from one end to the other as quickly as possible, and you can't, again, like the whole theory behind it is eliminating those moments where you can sit in a corner inside each other's bodies and just shoot in all directions and be perfectly safe and have one person melee, right? I mean, they want to eliminate those experiences, and I mean, for the most part, I think Crash Course does that, and it's a good exercise in that. It's reassuring in that way.
If you had to rate it relative to the other campaigns, is it... Is it as good or better or not quite as good?
Oh gosh, I think, I mean, obviously it's hard to rate because of that, of the length comparison. I mean, immediately you have less content, but I think.
But it's also free, so.
Unless you have an Xbox.
We're not counting those people.
People, you know, is a generous term.
I think I'd rate it, you know, in the top three of campaigns. I'm not sure how to rank them exactly. I would really have to.
Wait, isn't there only four?
Five now.
Oh,
yeah, there's five now. But again, like, just that openness. I mean, I think Crash Course encourages exploration more than any other chapter or section of Left 4 Dead. I mean, just the way there's all these little rooms and there's little outdoor sections and alleys that you can run down and not just have them dead end and not just have them be a place to put Molotovs, but kind of more genuinely, the world just feels a little more round and less linear, you know, less line shaped and more square shaped.
Although, I mean, once you've played through it a couple times, aren't you going to know exactly where to go and exactly, you know, where everything is? I mean, not where all the items are, because those shift around, and all the attacks shift around too, I guess. But the path, aren't you going to basically learn the path and just make a beeline for that?
Yeah, I mean, of course you're gonna develop your favorite path, but I think there is a fundamental difference in Crash Course in that there is almost always an alternate path, at least in my observation, to get from A to B.
Right.
Anyway, it's a small piece of content. We enjoyed it. Go play it. I haven't tried out the versus stuff.
Yeah, I was gonna say we're gonna need to try that and see if the alternate paths make it significantly more difficult to trap people.
Absolutely. All right. So moving on, And actually within the same topic of revisiting or having an excuse to revisit good games that we liked, Dawn of War 2, Warhammer 40,000 Dawn of War 2, is getting a standalone expansion. If you've received our December issue, which is the one with World of Warcraft Cataclysm on the cover, if I'm correct.
Yep.
Yes, okay. You already know, and you're well aware, across four pages that Relic is developing Warhammer 40,000 Dawn of War 2 Chaos Rising, which is a standalone expansion coming out next, I guess it's springish. That's what they're telling us. And it's going to add the Chaos faction, the Chaos Space Marines, to the game as a new enemy, as a new opponent after you defeated the Tyranid seemingly in the first campaign. And are you going to revisit the game, Dan? I know you're a big fan of it as well.
Definitely. And actually, you know, I'm a big fan of the gameplay. The fiction doesn't really do it for me, honestly. I've never been able to get into Warhammer fiction, but I do enjoy the game a lot. I like the action RPG aspect of it actually a lot. I really enjoy that type of gameplay. I haven't really gotten into the multiplayer, like the more RTS-y multiplayer. That didn't strike as much of a chord with me. But I'm honestly a little bit disappointed that they went for the Chaos, because they're one of the less interesting factions for me. I don't like their magic-y stuff in a sci-fi game, really. Mm-hmm. I would have rather have seen like the Necrons, or you know, the Necrons are probably my choice. They were one of my favorite factions to play around with in the first game. And they had a lot of different mechanics. And just a very unique look to them.
Yeah, they're sort of like Egyptian Borg almost, or ancient Borg.
Yeah, kind of, sort of. Mm-hmm. So,
I mean, the Chaos are very popular among the fan base. I definitely recognize the value of a different faction. I think they do make a good contrast, and this is kind of the case they made to me when I was at Relic a couple weeks ago, in that they're a personal enemy with history with the Space Marines, or they're a doppelganger to the Space Marines, whereas the Tyranids were more of a force of nature. This is kind of what they were selling me on, you know. Having an enemy that's talking to you throughout a battle, that's a little more deceptive, that's, you know, sort of shaking their fists and twirling their mustache and saying, "I'll get you next time, Space Marines," and so on. There's value there. And I'm glad you mentioned the multiplayer, Dan, because I almost forgot that before Chaos Rising comes out, they're going to be putting out a new free pack of multiplayer DLC called The Last Stand. And this is also kind of a survival mode that fits within, you know, what you've experienced in other games like Left 4 Dead. And I had a chance to play it while I was at Relic. And basically, you're going to choose one of three heroes, kind of like you do in multiplayer, the Space Marines, the Eldar, or an Orc character. And you'll choose different equipment to equip them with. And you basically defend against waves in a circular map. And you earn character-specific experience, and you'll earn more weapons and level up. And it was really fun. I'm looking forward to that very much. It's supposed to be coming this month.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that, too. It sounds really like, you know, a lot of very tactical gameplay in terms of just holding off big waves, which actually I was one of my disappointments with that game, not to spoil the ending, but there is a scene similar to that where you're fighting hordes of Tyranids and, you know, and like, at the last minute, you're rescued. I was kind of hoping actually that you would go out fighting, you know, just take as many of them with you as you can.
Sure.
That just seems so much more of a valiant ending to that game, and kind of in line with the Space Marines, they go on and on about, you know, how death in battle is a glorious thing. Mm-hmm. And I thought that would have been an awesome ending to the game, but I guess they wanted those characters to survive for later stuff.
But, yeah, and you will be able to transfer over all of your campaign, your characters, your war gear into the expansion. And if you read our coverage, you'll learn about something called the corruption system that they're introducing. It's sort of like the infestation system they have with the Tyranids, which was pretty simple. Admittedly, it didn't really affect too much.
Except now you get to play as Rod Blagojevich.
Yes, you play as a U.S. senator or a governor.
Governor.
Yeah, it's kind of a morality system. It, that is interesting. I found it interesting. Read more about it there, and we'll keep you guys updated, and we'll definitely let you know our impressions about The Last Stand when that comes out. We're expecting later this month. So next thing I wanted to get you guys talking about, sort of as a general roundtable-y topic this week, is the state of Steam and how we feel about the service, how far it's come. I'm sort of loving the sales, the trend of sales that they've had going on in the past year of just aggressively cutting prices on things. How they're able to do that, I'm still not sure. The re-indoctrination of all these indie games being re-released and published there. But what features would we like to see on Steam in the near future? What's necessary? Is something necessary? Do you have a big critique for the service? And yeah, feel free to fire away, guys.
And I guess my biggest critique as of now is the lack of quality control. They do seem to have at launch some problems with maybe because I mean basically what Steam does, what Valve does, is they give a developer all the tools to put their game on Steam, and then they just let them handle it. They say, okay, go ahead and put it up. And they don't check and make sure everything works right and that there are no issues. So it is a little bit prone to problems like that. And also, I mean, with Jedi Knight, when that came out on Steam, there were some issues there. It didn't have the music and, was crashing on a lot of computers. It would be nice to have some kind of standard of quality, some checks there.
I would agree with that. I think sort of as a contrast to that and moving in that direction, a lot of developers complain about the Xbox's certification process. And I've had developers tell me that in order to get games on there, I mean, it's a long grilling process. Microsoft, you know, hashes out how well the game works and how it functions and if there's any specific bugs. But they kind of, I mean, they'll give you 3 or 4 dates. All the Xbox Live arcade games come out on Wednesdays and they'll say, pick one of these dates to release your game. And I think a lot of developers like Steam because there's not this huge barrier to entry. I mean, they don't have to get things certified and wait. They sort of have more control over their stuff. So as long as it never gets into that direction, I definitely agree with you, Dan.
Yeah, I mean, there are degrees to it. I mean, obviously you don't want to go over the top and have just a huge bureaucratic annoying process that that prevents games from getting up there in a timely manner. And that everybody hates, that would be bad. But, you know, there's a happy medium there, I think.
I don't know, because I think right now Steam could say it's all in the developer's hands. I mean, and it's good that they have, you know, individual responsibility. This is your product, do it. But as soon as Steam makes any sort of kind of effort, like, okay, we'll do some control, then they're taking ownership for it. And then they're going to be blamed if anything's bad. I think it's best just to leave it entirely out of their hands, because as soon as they take some responsibility, they're going to take more and more, because then the fault's on them.
It's best for them, but is it best for the consumer? I'm just thinking as a player. Let's say they don't have any kind of standard of quality control, then they have to have a better return policy. They have to have a better way of getting your money back when something doesn't work.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Yeah, a return policy would be great.
But I mean, obviously with games, return policies are a sticky issue because, it has been done in the past where games have been pirated off of Steam. I mean, Half-Life 2 was pirated. But it's obviously not the easiest way to do it. So I don't think that's the main source of pirated copies. But you know, they have to be careful with that because people could easily scan that system. Could potentially scan that system.
I might consider saying where it's not a standard you can return anything, but when special issues come up like Jedi Knight that has a lot of problems, they say, okay, we're going to open Jedi Knight to be returned for the next 48 hours or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, there might be some compromise like that. I mean, who knows if that's even legal to do a limited return, Maybe if they just had like a window after you buy the game, you've got 24 hours to return it, or maybe not even that, because I mean, a lot of games can be played in 24 hours.
Sure.
But yeah, you've got maybe 2 hours to return it. Like, you know, buy it, test it. If it doesn't work, return it.
Who knows? I mean, I think they should definitely explore those options. And I'm sort of surprised to hear myself suggest this, but I've really liked some of the more social networky aspects that they've added to Steam in the past year. I mean, simple things like commenting on profiles and voice chat, I guess. I guess event scheduling has been there for a while, but I've started to use it more recently in our Steam group to pick up TF2 games together. I'd really like to see more of that. Like, Valve loves stat tracking, and I know they're tracking tons of metrics among their user base and every game that they publish, and probably within Steam itself. I'd love to see more of that attitude utilized for players and for consumers. I just love checking out things like how many hours everybody's put into games, and it's just a nice little bit of content that I think they should expand on when they find the opportunity to do so.
Yeah, I do too. There's a couple annoying things. I would love to be able to put people on my friends list in like different groups, or at least put a comment on them so I can remember, you know, who they are, how I know them, if it's someone, you know, I just kind of vaguely know. And grouping games on your list would be wonderful beyond just favorites.
Right. Yeah, I mean, one thing I love on a buddy list, I use Digsby for my IMs. One thing I love to be able to do is rename people on my screen. I mean, it's all well and good for them to be able to change their own names and show up however they want. But if I want somebody to show up as, like, you know, if Josh has his name as FU ambiguous, and I don't want to remember everybody's screen name to who they actually are. I just want to be able to change that to Josh. That is, I mean, for me, for just to be able to keep track of who's who is a big a big factor for me.
What do you call me on your buddy list, Dan?
I can't say it on the unregulated podcast. Yeah.
Valve does tons of metrics and they love their stats and stuff, but they never actually like ask you about any of their stat tracking except their annual hardware survey, in which they pop up a window and they ask you. I was just wondering if anyone had a problem with that, because Valve could take a lot of like data and commercialize on it, I guess. Is there any problem, like, do you guys see with stat tracking?
From a privacy perspective? I mean,
Yeah. I mean, from a privacy perspective. Because
are you worried that they know you played Zuma's Revenge? I mean,
my suckage is my own privacy.
Yeah, it's not at all sensitive information. I mean, it's just kind of, you know, you're playing this. I mean, it's not a big deal to me. I don't care that people know what I'm playing.
Well, no, I think Eric was saying they could do more surveys where they ask you questions directly and you'd fill out a form and answer. So they could potentially ask you more kind of compromising stuff.
Or you're just embarrassed that you spent 4 hours in the first level of Portal because you couldn't figure out where to go.
It doesn't tell anybody that. But Eric, are you just worried that it collects any information on you at all?
You know, I'm not that paranoid, I guess. But it does seem like, I don't know. I guess I haven't read the entire like Steam end user license agreement and stuff. So maybe there's a section in there that says, "Hey, we have the right to, you know, track whatever stats we want." It just seems weird that like no one would make a fuss about it if they you don't know what stats they're tracking. I guess you can see stuff in profiles, but they pull, I would guess, a lot of data down about everything you do in games.
But hypothetically, what's wrong with that? I mean, what could they possibly use for nefarious purposes?
They already have your credit card and name. I mean, they can't get much worse than that.
Well, they don't have your credit card if you don't buy any games off of there. Like if you bought something at retail and registered it with Steam, they still don't have your credit card information. But I mean, what kind of negative thing could they possibly collect on you based on your game playing habits?
I think it's just a matter of we know they're saying, okay, 80% of people that play Left 4 Dead also play these games, or look at this ad, or click on this part of the community section, or visit these forums. I think what kind of Eric and I are expressing are maybe use more of that effort and share it with the consumers. I mean, just, we know they're so good at it. We know they're so mathematically oriented and statistically oriented.
Share it with us how?
I don't know. I mean, they share the hardware survey with us, right? They publish the results of that.
I mean, infographs.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting information. But I mean, they have no obligation to share any of that stuff with us. I mean, that's information that they could sell and make money off of. So it's not really necessarily in their interest to share it when they can be selling it.
But do you think it's okay, like with a free service like that, to be selling information of the users?
Absolutely, I think it's okay. And there's why would that possibly be not okay?
If it's in the EULA, then yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Like I said, I haven't read all the way through, so maybe I don't have a legitimate concern here.
Well, I mean, say it's not in the EULA. That you're logging into their service. It's free. You're doing things on their service. Every website does the exact same thing. They track how long people they track what links you click on. They track how long you look at a web page. They track where you go from there.
Right, but the difference is Steam has that link to your name and your personal identity, where websites can't. They just store information in general sums, where Steam could say, Josh Augustine did this for this long, and Eric did this for this long.
Any website that you put your credit card information into or create an account into does the exact same thing.
Right, but those all have EULAs as well,
I'm certain Steam has the same thing, but... In fact, I'm looking on their support page right now for privacy policy. That's at the bottom here. There's a Steam subscriber agreement.
Are we talking about
agreement.
Skynet or Steam?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Before we get too far into legal agreements and that kind of language, I think it's safe to say like we all want to see the next version of Steam. I kind of feel like it's the time for them to do a big update on the service. Hopefully, that's led by Steam Cloud, because I get really annoyed when I can't use my Zuma's Revenge game save to play challenge levels at work.
Nice. Yeah, wasn't that supposed to happen like a long time ago? I'm really confused.
So, if I'm correct, and I may be incorrect because it hasn't been fully rolled out, they just rolled out like the key binding aspect of it. So,
I thought that had been rolled out a long time ago.
Yeah, I mean, they only rolled that out, that aspect out a while ago. But, you know, the game saving part, which is the critical and then big and helpful part of it, didn't seem to be in place, especially for third-party games and first-party games. So, and that's what we're all waiting on.
And that's a much more massive undertaking for anybody who, right, for any, like we talked about this a couple weeks ago. I thought basically the size of save games, it gets pretty big. So once you're offering to save like somebody's Half-Life or Fallout 3 saves, I mean, that could get pretty big. There's no limitation on how many save games you can have in that game. And if they did something where it's like you can choose one save game to host, that would be cool, except that would take a lot of third-party games that would have to rewrite their save system to handle that. So it's logistically, it's a big undertaking. And I agree with you, it would be awesome. But it's I understand why it's taking as long as it is.
I think they should start with first party games. That's kind of a fair expectation, I think. To some extent, I want to think that they've made some effort in that direction with the TF2 backpack system that they're slowly introducing more updates to, that carries across your profile no matter where you log into. It keeps track of what weapons you have, and they're going to introduce a trading system in there. So maybe
that's a little different though. That's different from a save game, because that's all server side. That's stuff that's stored in your profile that you log into. Whereas a save game would be with a single player game where you are progressing through a single player game's campaign, and you can save at any point you want and upload those all to a server. That's a massively different thing.
Okay. If you say so, I guess I don't understand the technology as well.
Well, I mean, think about it. You're logging into your account and your account is storing on their server. It's basically going to be a few text files storing what you have in your account, and it's stored there because otherwise, if it's stored on your computer, then you can just mess with it and cheat. But it's a very small file that they're keeping on each person who has an account. Whereas a save game, that's all stored locally on your computer. Those files can be anywhere from, you know, a few kilobytes to tens of megabytes. Depending on the game, and there's a pretty big difference there.
Steam is almost so big that I'm starting to consider alternatives a lot of the time when something's available for digital distribution. I'm like, gonna stick it to the man.
You want to encourage competition a little bit?
Yeah, just a little bit. If there's especially if there's a sale going on.
But go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I was just saying what Direct-to-Drive's have in their crazy 5-year anniversary sale, and they've had like BioShock, and I'm trying to think of other titles, but they've had a lot of games for just $5, and deals you don't even see on Steam, and so I've been shopping there recently.
Oh yeah, I mean, Steam by no means has necessarily the best deals. I mean, Impulse often has deals that undercut Steam's. And yeah, the Direct-to-Drive sale is an excellent opportunity. I mean, we've been plugging that on our Facebook feed just because it's like deals you just can't pass up if you have any interest in those games. And $5 for a game like BioShock does sleep in mind. I'm trying to remember what else they had in
Defense
there.
Grid.
Assassin's Creed. Just a bunch of really great stuff.
Right now, World of Goo, Defense Grid, Sword of the Stars. I don't know what that is, actually.
Sword of the Stars is a strategy game. Those are less impressive deals just because, you know, indie games started at a lower price point. But, I mean, they're still good deals.
Mountain Blade.
Yeah, again, that one didn't start at $50 either.
All right, good discussion, guys. Let us know in the comments what the feature that you want Valve to prioritize and add to Steam next. You know, what's the most important thing they need to roll out to be this continue to be the flagship service for most PC gamers in terms of just the popularity. And we'll be curious to hear what you have to say. Andy, it is to my understanding you have some questions for us to answer.
I just got them off the Gmail account, which you guys can send your questions to. Attachments are welcome. Voicemails are welcome. PCGamerPodcast@gmail.com or 1-877-404-1337, extension 724. It'll get you straight to the voicemail box like this guy here.
Hello, PC Gamer Podcast. This is Peter from Connecticut. And me and my friends are starting up a Team Fortress 2 team competitively online. So we're wondering, what do you guys do to play online, or do you guys play competitively at all? Love the podcast, love your magazine, and I've been listening since episode 1, and I can't wait for 200.
What a nice man. He's a completionist of our podcast. All right, so playing TF2 competitively, it's a wonderful game to play competitively because it's so popular. There's a lot of avenues for entry in terms of the leagues and the ladders available if you're interested in terms of like the skill level. You don't have to be super hardcore. You can be sort of casual. You can play week to week. You can play seasonally. I would definitely check out TWL, and their website is Team Warfare League. TeamWarfare.com is where you want to go. And I don't know. I'm not sure what else he's wondering. I mean, in terms of structure, it's pretty obvious. I mean, depending on the commitment level of the people involved, it's usually fun to have practices. I mean, in most cases, depending on your league, they'll have either one map that everybody in that league is playing every week, or if you're doing sort of a challenge-based ladder league, the map is determined randomly, you know, within a few days in advance, and you'll have some time to play that and practice that in advance and go over strategies. And obviously, one thing I'd recommend, if you want to look into getting a Ventrilo server, and those are actually very cheap, you know, within probably under $20 a month for maybe at least a dozen slots, that gives you an inherent advantage in that when you're dead, you can keep talking to your teammates, and it's not cheating, thankfully. So, yeah, it's a fantastic thing. I'm glad you're looking into playing competitively. It's really rewarding, and have a blast. I don't know what else to say.
Hey, hello, PC Gamer Podcast. This is Dan from Massachusetts with a quick question about graphics cards. I'm currently running a 8800 GT. I'm looking for an upgrade that will last me for another 2.5 years or so until I transition. And I don't want to spend, you know, $300, $400. I was wondering what would be a good city card that will last me that long. Thanks. I appreciate your response.
That's a bit of a challenge. 2.5 years under 350, let's say, or at 350?
You know, the 8800 GT did do that exact thing. It was really, it lasted me at least 2 years. Or how many years did he say? Two?
Yeah, two and a half years.
Two and a half years. It lasted that long with well under that much money. But I mean, this is going to be a perfect time for me to talk about my new 5870. But it's
which is out of that price range.
Yeah, unfortunately.
the 5850 is apparently doing reviewing well for about 250.
Oh yeah, it's about 260. It looks like listed.
So I guess that's the top of the line card in that price range right now.
Even if you do spend $400, including overnight shipping, on a 5870, you will be so happy. You'll get twice as much performance out of your PC as it stands.
Relative to
an 8800 GT, because that's what I upgraded from too.
Right. But you won't double your performance from like a GTX 285, but right. You have to qualify those statements.
Well, in the context of this guy's question, yeah.
Right.
Do you guys think a 4870 X2 would last a couple years?
Hard to say. I mean, depends on what you mean by last. I mean, will it run games that come out in 2 years? Yes. Will it run them really well? No. But it won't be completely obsolete in 2 years, no.
Hello, PC Gamer. This is Knu from Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. I had a question about game mechanics, more of a discussion. I wanted to see your thoughts on about incorporating personal hobbies into games. I am a very big photographer, and I love when I see games incorporate things like using a camera as part of the game mechanic. And some of the more obvious hobbies like fishing, sports, or chess are obviously games entirely devoted to them. But what are your guys' thoughts on less common hobbies that people take part in being included as part of a game or even a game all about it? Should this be done? Is there a market for it? What are your thoughts? Thanks, guys. Keep the great work.
As an avid hobbyist of headshots, I'm happy to see them included in games.
What other kind of hobbies? The main thing is just if you can make it fun gameplay, then yes. But if your hobby is taxidermy, how would you do that? I mean,
you could do a mini game.
Photography is definitely a good example. Yeah. A good example of one where, I mean, you wouldn't necessarily have to create a realistic, you know, in the Crysis engine or something, photographic game where you're taking pictures of birds and getting points for it. I mean, you can find other ways to introduce that concept and still.
Dude.
Did I get something right there, Andy?
Yes.
Did
you like that? Because as soon as he was talking about the photography being one of his hobbies, and BioShock did it so cool. They had the camera like system, but then they had that one little section of the game where the guy was like sadistic and he had you take pictures of all the people you killed.
Yep.
I must have spent like so long trying to get the best like frame of that of the picture. Like I was gonna make those pictures so good, and it didn't even matter if you really like got it like aesthetically pleasing at all. But I spent so much time getting those pictures like bomb, and no one even was able to see that I did that. I loved that segment of the game using the camera in that way. Like more stuff like that, please. That'd be so cool.
You can turn it into a collection for photography. You can turn it into a collection game, mini game kind of thing. Where and I guess you could say in Batman Arkham Asylum they do a very similar thing, although there's no actual camera involved. Where you know you're looking for the object and you pushed the scan surface. Yeah, the scan button, which is basically take picture. Mm-hmm. And there are a couple of Riddler puzzles, in fact, where you have to line up your shot exactly. You have to stand in the exact right place to get things to line up. So you're basically taking a picture of it.
The reason I think camera works so well is because the mechanics are basically the same as you'd find in a video game. You point at something, you cloak. Yeah. And that's the trouble with bringing, say, you know, taxidermy, you know, train building or anything like that, is the mechanics are just so different. You'd have to do kind of a mini game that just happens to be themed that way.
Well, what about like snowboarding in Sonic 3?
Well, I mean, there are plenty of snowboarding games.
I know, I'm just kidding.
No, I definitely get what Josh is saying in terms of you'd have to make the hobby into a game. You'd have to attach something like another mechanic, like points onto it or lives or some sort of system of success.
All I'm saying is in Mass Effect 2, there better be skiing. Yo, bro! I'm going to join your suicide crew, but I'm ski first.
Andy.
Think about it, dude.
You're doing well, this podcast. You're doing well. But on the topic of photography, this reminded me of... So I did a feature in our December issue where I got together with this group of ARMA players that play the game in like a very militarized and hardcore way. They have a chain of command. They have radio procedure.
That stuff is so cool.
And I mean, again, I mean, this is something that I think defines how people can create their own experiences on PC. And I think that's part of what this guy is talking about, which gets me excited. But they edited the code in their mission to let me be a battlefield reporter. Basically, I didn't have a weapon. Oh. I wasn't shooting with him. I was just sort of running around, and I was tagged as
journalist.
Exactly. I was tagged as a non-combatant within the game scripting. So the enemies weren't targeting me. And I could just run around freely and sort of frame shots. And it was a really cool experience.
That's
in a lot
cool
of ways.
But, yeah. That's like, I love reading about that stuff. That's I'm gonna eat that up.
But I think kind of what I'm saying to this guy is I think those opportunities exist out there. I mean, whether it's in a sim racing game or I've heard about people that sort of merge their enthusiasm for, I don't know what to call it. I mean, flight basically, you know, sort of commercial flight. They build whole sort of mock-up cockpits in their garage, you know, with as many systems and authentic things in there. This is getting really dorky, but what I'm saying is, and they sort of build in a PC into that, and they have, you know, their force feedback system, they have their joystick, and they have other people that they play with in the community that are their virtual air traffic controller people, and, you know, help them through this fake moment of flying between Chicago to San Francisco in real time and things like that. And I think you're not going to get that anywhere else, you know, not on a console, certainly. And I guess for the purpose of discussion, if anybody has some very specific communities out there to recommend, please feel free to share them with us. So we've been playing in the office some very interesting things this week that I'm not sure if we can talk about yet. But other than that, Dan Stapleton, I've seen you playing some Zuma's Revenge, and that's very encouraging to me.
I have. It's a very addictive little game. Kind of frustrating to me in that it seems a little bit too much randomness and not enough skill kind of thing. Like the randomized order of the balls every time makes it, you know, a good player can get screwed over pretty easily.
That's fair to say.
Yeah, and like the being really successful is and almost entirely dependent on getting the right power ups at the right time. So it's not a game that you can that is really good for like, you know, I want to get really good at this game and be rewarded for that, because You will, like, if you get good at it, you will be, you, it will improve your playing abilities, but it won't guarantee that you'll be able to handle these situations, because they're not really crafted puzzles because of the random element.
Sure.
But it is very addictive. And I do find myself, firing it up just to kill some time, and then, you know, look up and realize I killed more time than I intended.
Yep. It's definitely that just one more.
Yep.
Definitely. Anything else?
Nothing I can talk about yet.
Right. Of course. Josh Augustine, with your handy $90 beer stein, that is wealth.
Yes. Lich King. Well, we got to go down to Blizzard on Friday with the WoW Mag, and so I heard about a lot of the stuff that's ahead of that's going to be coming up in the game, so I just got really excited about it. So I've been playing a lot of World of Warcraft, doing Arena with my buddy James. We got to 1350, which isn't great, but our gear is crappy, so it's pretty good. And then been playing a lot of browser MMOs for the, what is that, January issue? Holiday issue.
Holiday.
Cool. Good holiday issue, yeah.
Mr. Eric, other than the moving my stuff into a room Tetris game, which we all enjoy.
Okay, I've been playing a game called X3 Terran Conflict. I think it came out last year, and it got pretty mediocre reviews because it was really buggy, but it's now up to version like 2.5, I think, and it's apparently much improved. And I've really been enjoying it because I haven't had a really good like hardcore space simulator since, I don't know, like Free Space 2 in 2001. So that's kind of been my game of choice as of late. Other than that, I guess Scribblenauts, but that's a DS game.
Yeah, no, I've been playing Scribblenauts too.
Is it true that you can type in keyboard cat?
Yes.
Does he just come on and then kind of play everybody else off the screen, or what happens?
You can just kind of pick him up and set him down, and he plays the keyboard. It doesn't actually even play the song, but they've got like Long Cat and Ceiling Cat. They've got a lot of
Ceiling Cat.
Yeah, they've got a lot of references in there. It's a fun game.
It's a collection of novelties. All right, Andy Bauman.
Oh, dude, Scribblenauts is that game where you can just do your hobby in the game. Because you can spawn, like, a camera. No, you can't really take pictures, I guess.
You can make things, but none of them work.
Yeah, you can spawn your things, but then you can just look at them.
That's great. Andy, what you doing?
I'm still working my way through Batman AA. Because, you know,
how far are you
to beat games these days. I'm at the Botanical Gardens where you run back and try and stop.
Has anyone else gotten to gotten around to playing the challenge modes yet?
No, not yet. I'm not ready to just do the challenge.
I've spent so much time, trying to get a good score in the challenge modes, and nobody's even trying to compete against me. You're pissing me off.
What's the best one this weekend? I'm going to power through, and I'm going to beat your score. What's your score on what level?
All right, on the Totally Insane DLC, that's the one I'm most proud of, is 89,000.
89,000. All right, I'm going to get 89,001.
I rounded up. You should be able to see my score on the leaderboards.
Oh, is it based off like Steam Friends?
No, well, it's no. It's Games for Windows Live.
Yeah.
How far are you guys in Batman? You've beat it, Dan, because...
Twice.
And then Evan?
I am less far than that because I've been distracted by other games. But
what?
Sorry.
I know. It's like the best game.
It's surprising to me too. I know.
I'm just really jealous of you guys because I got Batman off Steam and it shuts down my computer. Literally.
Oh.
I have no idea why. It just shuts down my computer.
No. Sounds like overeating.
Well, but like I've never had a problem with any other game. Maybe it is. I'll work on it more this weekend.
There could be some kind of driver problem. Sometimes does it actually turn it off? Well,
yeah.
My
computer just straight up shuts down.
So does it turn off or does it restart?
It turns off.
Okay, that's weird. That's not good.
That sounds power supply E.
It sounds like a heat problem to me.
Sounds like a problem for Logan Decker.
Logan, where are you? Oh, he's not here. All right, so as for myself, I've discovered a neat little game called Alien Shooter. It's I think it's a few years old. It's at least like 2004 or something like that. And there's a lot of iterations of it on Steam. There's like Alien Shooter Vengeance and Alien Shooter 2 and Zombie Shooter. But it's reminded me of a lot of cool experiences. It has that isometric perspective that the original Fallout games do. But it's more of an action game like Crusader, No Regret or Crusader, No Remorse. And you're basically, you're just clearing the area of enemies like Diablo, again, another old game, and you're upgrading your weapons and getting new weapons and grenade launchers, and just there's heavy metal cords in the background that kick in when enemies come at you, and secret areas to explore like Doom. And we had a question a couple weeks back where a guy was asking about dungeon crawlers and, other games other than Titan Quest to check out. And, even though this isn't explicitly a dungeon crawler, even though it doesn't have multiplayer that I know of, I definitely recommend taking a look at it. It's a very arcadey, fast paced, like kill everything in sight and blow things up. And I just love isometric graphics, like just the detail of the sprites and seeing things in motion, the color palette. I think it's worth playing. Other than that, Zuma's Revenge, of course, as always. I've aced 55 or so of the 70 challenge levels. And yeah, that's what I've been up to. As Andy Bauman already mentioned, if you'd like to submit a question for next week, feel free to give us a call at 877-404-1337, extension 724. And please limit your call to 60 seconds or our machine will explode and cut you off and we'll never hear what those precious few moments after 60 ever were. And but if you'd like to avoid all that and just submit a question over email, that's perfectly fine. PCGamerPodcast@gmail.com. We'd also encourage guys to subscribe to our wonderful magazine at PCGamer.com. And thanks for joining us next week. Feel free to let us know in the comments how you feel about the Mass Effect 2 trailer, how you feel about Crash Course, if you're looking forward to the Dawn of War 2 expand-alone game. And we'll see you next week, guys. Take care. Have a great weekend.
I'm trying to down to hot chocolate scandal instead of hot coffee.
What's that?
Why is it chocolate?
I don't know.
What are you talking about?
Because the code is left in the game.
Oh.
Except it's not sex. It's just a real ending.
Restoration Project.
Team Wisdom from Andy Bauman.
Well, if we're talking about sex, then why don't you just bleep? Say it.
God.